For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as in a cave. We invite you now to join us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, and Joseph Tomasian. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford, in the cave with me, your two favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle, and this is episode 3 of our series on metaphysics. Now, it's a deep, deep subject. For the past 2 episodes, we've kind of been circling the plane. Are we going to be able to land it today, or are we going to, you know, continue to circle, take a look at some more things that fall under this mega heading of metaphysics? And then wait for Joseph to come back and help us land this thing.
That's a good question. Yeah. It brings to mind the scenes from that classic comedy Airplane, you know, where they're flying like, oh, we need someone to help fly the plane, you know. And so, yeah, this has been a lot of fun for me and hopefully for the audience, too. But yeah, Mark, we better dive in and see if we make some progress.
Well, I think the reason we've been doing these shows on metaphysics is to talk ultimately about one metaphysical system, and that's Thomism, and the metaphysics of St. Thomas Aquinas. And the reason why I think it is difficult for us to quote unquote end this discussion ever is because I think in the modern world, in our contemporary setting, St. Thomas's metaphysical system is under massive fire. Basically the entire world outside of the Catholic world, and even large chunks of the Catholic world, have grown beyond St. Thomas. I think that's the best way to put it. It's not that they've rejected St. Thomas, but right. their metaphysical perspectives have grown and matured to where, you know, his writing is an interesting artifact, and the truths are reflected in the truths of other metaphysical systems, but like science, like other studies, we've progressed beyond it. And I think trying to therefore go back and hold tight to St. Thomas Aquinas, that may not be the only position a Catholic can take.
I think that's a really interesting point and a good launching off point for today's episode, today's discussion. So I'm going to maybe just share around what we mean. So we use the word Thomism. We're going to use it throughout the show. We've used it in other shows. And It's Thomism, Thomism, based on Thomas, right? St. Thomas Aquinas. So those he's referred to as the angelic doctor, you know, he's a great, great saint, doctor of the church. And those who, you know, he lived in the 13th century, and those who continue to study and try to build off of his work, his theological and philosophical writings, which are considered really kind of the gold standard in the Catholic sphere, at least, those schools are called Thomism. So that's Thomism, is sort of carrying Aquinas's work forward to both understand what he wrote, but then try to advance it. And those schools of Thomism, academically, I think they reside probably exclusively now in Catholic university and institutes, and seminaries. And so where his work is still very much alive and being advanced, efforts that be advanced. One of our favorites is I don't know if he's really breaking new ground per se, but retrieving him and presenting him afresh is like an Edward Fazer,
right,
for example. So any number of Catholic scholars, and it's often a bona fides to be a... So if you're in that school, if you're in that camp of Aquinas, then you're also called... so that school's called Thomism, and then you would be called a Thomist, right? A tomist, T-H-O-M-I-S.
Yeah, and you know, actually, I'm glad you brought up Edward Fazer. I think Edward Fazer's works are probably a good guide for this discussion to a certain extent. And obviously, Dr. Fazer is a huge champion of St. Thomas, champion of Thomism. So I think his defense of Thomism is probably one of the most robust in the face of what I would say modern critics of Thomism are launching at him. Now, I would argue that a lot of what Dr. Fazer argues against may be in the realm of straw men. The challenges that he's putting forward is these are the challenges against St. Thomas. They may not be exactly what the argument is, but in Dr. Fazer's favor, I think that's because there's never really been a robust challenge against St. Thomas. He's just sort of dismissed.
I would agree with that. He's not like formally rejected, right, or refuted. Exactly. He's sort of neglected and left in the past like a distant relative.
Right, right. So let's break this down a little bit. And when we're talking about Thomism, what are some of the metaphysical commitments that we're talking about? And first and foremost, I think... Thomas puts forward a understanding of the universe that can be described as formal realism. And so what that means is, first off, there is a real world. And as much as you have to state that's outside myself.
I'm not just imagining things.
There are some metaphysical systems, although they're rare and few and far between and sort of weird. But there are some metaphysical systems that posit, no, the only thing that exists is really, or the only thing that we can know really is within our heads and between our ears, and the outside world may or may not exist. So the existence of the outside world is somewhat in question. So, going back to like some of the Enlightenment, and believe it or not, I think this was more prominent in sort of an empiricist school of looking at things, where, the only things you can actually know are those that you can touch, feel, taste, know through your senses. That led to a complete doubting of the senses, which led to a skepticism of the existence of the outer world beyond what we can actually experience. So like Berkeley, I think he would be one of the most prominent of the, I guess, skeptics of realism that says there actually is an outside world out there. Immanuel Kant gets thrown in there, but Kant wasn't really skeptical about the existence of an outside world. What he was skeptical about is our ability to know the objects in the outside world.
Yeah, he would say you can't.
Well, no, he'd say you know that it exists. You, the existence,
right,
is,
but
certain,
you can't know the objects, but, because the objects are always mitigated by,
right, exactly,
the phenomena.
Exactly. So
and
what
then,
we can
then
know,
the categories of your mind.
Right, right. But the phenomena do actually correspond to actual things in the world. We just only know them through their phenomena. Exactly.
Right.
Which, honestly, we'll do a whole show on Kant at some point, but I think that,
but he's a good foil for Aquinas, because I think one of the big contrasts between Aquinas and the current setting, or part of the current setting established by Kant, is I think St. Thomas Aquinas, following Aristotle, would say our intellects reach out to reality and can come in contact with it reliably through the senses. Kant says, no, reality comes into us mitigated through the phenomena, and then the categories of our mind make sense of it.
Correct, correct.
So it's a complete 180 from where Aquinas says the mind reaches out. Kant says, no, reality reaches in.
Right, right. Now, the word that you used in there was reliability, and Kant would not argue that our senses are unreliable at all. As a matter of fact, that's what he was vouchsafing, was the reliability of our senses. So the sense data we're taking in is a complete reliable, completely reliable mapping of the outer world. But what we know is that map. For instance, when you go to Colorado, you don't know the streets and roads of Colorado, but you know the map. And what you picture in your mind of Colorado is what is there in the map. The reality of it comes to you from driving. Somebody had to make the map, right? They had to drive and chart it out. But that chart is what's in your mind. And when you go to a place, what you know of it is in your mind. And so the reality of it, as we know it, is in our mind. But it's not that Colorado doesn't exist. It's not that the streets and places in Colorado don't exist, but our knowledge of it is only known kind of through how we were able to map it and process it in our minds.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. Yeah. That's a way of looking at Kant.
And I think in future shows, we should dive into Kantian metaphysics, because I think his metaphysical positions are pretty much the water we swim in. That, you know, for the most part, when you go out and you talk to people about what is reality, it's been, once again, it's been improved upon, I think, since Kant wrote. But I think at base, most people take a Kantian position as far as reality goes. It's just sort of that durable, common sense, everyday understanding of the universe.
Yeah, maybe we should think about, yeah, that might be the case. I always thought, I've always read Kant and understood him to, because he's standing there in the 18th century, and I see him as trying to bring together that, you know, as the synthesis of the empirical world, or the empirical school, if you will. But then there's also the world of kind of idealism as it pertains to morality. So he doesn't want to reside, say, strictly, I would say, like a David Hume's camp where everything is he's an empiricist. He wants to safeguard that for the sake of what we would call, you know, the hard sciences. But Kant also though recognizes that morality has truths and metaphysics of its own that he wants to affirm, and he lands on duty,
right,
and then he formulates that in a categorical imperative. So, and then he tries to, I highly recommend this. So Hillsdale College has a free online courses lecture series, and they have one I was listening to recently on Introduction to Western Philosophy. And so that's super good. I really, really enjoy it. Have enjoyed it. And they bring up Kant in there. And I think the way the professor talks about it is that Kant kind of has kind of two lenses that he's trying to view reality through. One, the empirical metaphysical set of glasses, and then he also wants, though, simultaneously to have you look at morality too. And where morality isn't morality, really, I would say for Kant and myself, including Aquinas, doesn't rest on the empirical sciences. Morality rests in principles and concepts.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a very accurate description of Kant. Well, we're coming up on a break, and we'll get back to St. Thomas Aquinas after the break. But you're listening to The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Herding cars, trucks, homes, businesses, workshops, garages, man caves, and she sheds.
We're with you wherever you go. Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Tim O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle and our trusty sidekick and producer, Kent Blanford. We are continuing our series on metaphysics with an eye today to the angelic doctor, St. Thomas Aquinas. So the last segment, Kant really got the lion's share of our attention.
I know.
But rightfully so, because he's a brilliant thinker, Kant. I have my disagreements certainly with him, but he's formidable you think of anything to do with philosophy. He's a formidable thinker for sure.
Right, and the contrast where Kant came up was talking about philosophers that disagree with St. Thomas's stance of formal realism. So realism being the existence of actual things outside of our heads, that the reality actually exists and out there, and formal being that the things that constitute reality have ideal essences, right? And I'm going to use the word ideal to try to connect it with other other sort of thinkers that talk similarly to St. Thomas about things. But what we see are not just a big buzzing whirl of confusion, the way Bertrand Russell would describe reality, right? Mm-hmm. He described, if you were to rely only on eyesight or hearing or our senses for what we see, all we would see are these big splotches of color, and all we would hear would be sort of noise. But our ability to put those into actual objects comes because those objects have essences to them. Mm-hmm. They have a formal reality that exists logically prior, and I think that's an important term. We'll have to define that in a second. Logically prior to the reality of the objects themselves, or not the reality of the objects themselves, but the appearance of the objects themselves. Mm-hmm. So what all that means, to unpack that a little bit. When we're talking about, say, a car, right? When we see it, we see the color of the car. We might be able to perceive a little bit of depth, right? So depth perception might kick in to be able to do that.
Yeah, extension maybe might be the word.
Right. So, but that's really what comes to us from our eyesight. But what we're able to apprehend about the car is the actual object of the car. We're able to actually see a car, not just the colors and all of that. And what allows us to actually see the car is that there is an essential essence to the car. And it that essence is particular, but it also participates in sort of a universal form of cars, right? So there's a universal that our mind's able to grasp out of a car that's not only to say, oh, look, that's an object that I can call a car, but in saying that it's a car, it has a universal meaning that we can then translate to all cars.
Yes. So, yeah, sometimes called universal concepts. So you look at a car. I think the point you're making is you look at think of one of your own, maybe you have more than one car. Think of your particular car that you own. And when you look at that, and I'll just call it an object, you look at that object, it has certain properties, features, characteristics. And we move from that particular, the move intellectually is this move of abstraction where the human mind is able to leave behind non-essential qualities, characteristics, properties, and we're able to grab onto just the essential things that make the object what it is. So, for example, like you were mentioning, it doesn't. When we think about car as a universal concept, that your particular car is part of, has a nature or essence or form consistent with other cars. It doesn't really matter that your car, you leave behind the fact that the color of your car is yellow or the color of your car is red. That's not what's, the color of the car isn't what makes it essentially a car. Things that would make it point to the essence of a car is that it has four wheels, that it has an engine, that it has seats, that it has a steering wheel and mechanisms. So you can, it has a certain shape, although with cars, there's a lot of variety. I think the easiest thing, I like to go back to, I'm a simple man, Mark. So I go back to childhood. So there's a toy, we're all familiar with it. It's kind of circular and it's got all the different animals on it. And you turn the little dial, you point to the animal and then you pull the string. And it tells you, point to the bear, and it says, oh, this is a bear. And then you point to another one, and then, oh, this is a sheep, and another one that's a dog. So what you're doing is you're beginning to teach, it's for toddlers, you're beginning to teach children who have the beginnings of linguistic skills, beginning use of language, you're beginning to show them that when you point to a German Shepherd and call it a dog, you point to a Chihuahua, call it a dog. You point to a Barney the Wonder Dog, the 120-pound chocolate lab that we have, and you keep calling this thing, you're saying these are all dogs, yet they have, there's a lot of variance in terms of color, size. So those are what would be called accidental properties or characteristics. What you're trying to teach them about the cat, there are categories of dog that these are all participating in or fit in because of the essence of what they have, the kind of nature that they have.
Right, right. And, I think where St. Thomas, I think this is sort of where St. Thomas comes into question a little bit in the modern world, is not so much that we're able to form categories of things, but how we're able to form those categories of things. And the question comes in, are those categories of things something that we have to learn? In other words, are they things that are ways that we are able to compartmentalize things in our own brains and our own heads to be able to say, okay, yeah, all of these types of things that I've seen, they fit within the file in my head. Like I've got a big filing mm-hmm. cabinet there and they fit within the dog file. Right. And then all of these things over here, they fit within the cat file and I can sort them and there's some conventions to it, right? You know, there may be some, like I think there's a species of wolf that can climb trees, right? So cats are traditionally things.
Well, that'd be troublesome.
Right, exactly, yeah. So cats are traditionally things that we see as part of their essential characteristic or that they can climb trees.
Yeah,
right.
Those claws.
But there's this wolf over here that can climb a tree. Does that make it a cat? I don't know.
Right,
you know, we
right.
can kind of arbitrarily put it in one category or the other based on some of those essential attributes, right? Or are these things that are fixed and part of the entities themselves? And that's really kind of the question. Is a wolf, and I think the question then is the particular nature of something, does it come prior, logically, prior to the universal nature of something? And that's one of the first questions that gets thrown out there for St. Thomas. And what I would say is modern science operates by and large off of the notion that the particular characteristics of an individual object are logically prior to the universal category that they eventually get filed into, not vice versa. And that's where you kind of go, well, have we moved beyond St. Thomas to a certain extent? Is science possible by having that universal as logically prior? And it may sound like, I mean, obviously you can still study things if that universal is logically prior, but a lot of science is categorization. A lot of it is characterizing things and moving things around. You know, one thing that we thought was a cat, well, now we think it's a dog. Planets, there's a great example, planets, right? We created a new category of dwarf planets, right? So now Pluto is no longer a actual planet. It is a dwarf planet, and we only have 8 planets in our solar system, although that maybe have changed too. But the category of planet, dwarf planet, etc., these are not essential descriptions of the entity, but they're categories that we've put them in. And, you know, the question is, which way does science operate today?
I think you're correct in that. I would say, yeah, the hard sciences probably operate in the way in which you're describing. What I think, where St. Thomas Aquinas, drawing from Aristotle, talks about the four causes, which we brought up before. I think what you see in modern science and just a lot of our kind of our contemporary setting is for Aquinas and Aristotle, to know the cause is to know what a thing is. So those are called real definitions. What you're describing in the setting that so what you're describing in the current setting to me would probably fit more along the lines of like I hear you describing things like that's kind of with planets. It's sort of like there's a change in naming conventions. We kind of just we come up with sort of methodologies by which we're organizing our own thoughts about how we're talking about these things or thinking about these things, and that's independent of that the object may have an actual form or final cause in and of itself. And that's something Bishop Barron brought out. That's who I got, where in the current, the four causes, formal, final, efficient, and material in the current setting, we think almost primarily in terms of efficient and material causes. And then what really gets us in that camp is the sheer speed and amazing advancements in science and technology especially, gives one and the hyper emphasis on change, and that gives us a kind of mindset or orientation towards the exterior world that everything is in flux, which I think actually goes back to, I'm going to harken back to Francis Bacon, because it was kind of his call that we should, part of his four-part enterprise was, I think it was number three, was to really tame nature, to really kind of coerce nature and compel nature to do what we want of it. And I think in many ways we've succeeded.
Right.
Or at least had a lot of success.
Yeah, and you know, there's
and that would be contrary to what Aquinas is.
Right. And you know, I mean, I think even when you look at the idea of permanence and and a discussion of permanence, I think we downplay a lot when we, and we'll just leave it at we. We downplay a lot the role of human psychology within the establishment of permanence. So, and permanence, of course, is a metaphysical, you know, that also is sort of a metaphysical category, a metaphysical commitment that you have is the universe more or less a stable entity, or is it a constantly changing entity that's in flux? And I think that really comes down to the dividing line between what we see as nature versus what we see as the world. So, you know, the Greek distinction would be the cosmos versus, gosh, I'm blanking on my Greek.
Universe.
Yeah. Well,
that's what Charles Taylor does in his book. He makes the distinction that we've moved from cosmos, which is ripe with an enchantment, if you will, that there's a supernatural quality to it, to something that's secular, which we call universe. But with that, all right. Cliffhanger there. Let's pick that up after the break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy has a great new lineup for your lunchtime listening. At noon on Mondays, it's Beyond Damascus with Dan DeMott and Aaron Richards, sharing the life-changing testimonies of ordinary people serving Christ and His Church. Tuesdays, it's Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler, serving up samples of some of the best Catholic podcasts available on the internet. Wednesdays, it's Catholic Jukebox Indiana, an hour of contemporary music with a Catholic message. On Thursdays, join Tim O'Donnell, Mark Tuttle, and Joseph Tomasian in the Catholic Cave for a lively discussion of philosophical thought with a heavy dose of Catholic wisdom. And Friday, it's the Bishop Strickland Hour, with Bishop Joseph Strickland of the Catholic Diocese of Tyler, Texas. Just some food for thought on your lunch hour from your friends at Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell and with our wonderful producer, Kent Blanford. And we are doing part three of our series on metaphysics. We're dedicating today's
show. Part three of 30.
I know, no. Exactly. That's what it seems like, because it seems like every time. And, you know, this is part of the nature of metaphysics.
Right.
That the more we talk about it, the deeper we seem to get into it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing. But we were just talking about the metaphysical commitment of living within an ordered cosmos versus a denatured, static, well, not static, constantly changing, constantly moving natural universe.
That's comprised of material stuff.
Material stuff. And the nature of material things, and this gets back to the formal realism of St. Thomas, the nature of material things is to constantly change, to constantly break down, to constantly be, you know, growing and then fading, right? I mean, that's what we see in nature. You know, Heraclitus was the great pre-Socratic philosopher of change. You know, he very famously, you know, said that you can't step into the same river twice, because the river is constantly changing.
Everything's changed.
And that really is sort of the natural world, and that's our experience of the natural world. This idea of permanent things, though, And that there's a permanence. I think it comes about from man's ability to manipulate nature, and to create permanence out of the constant flux. And so I think that's part of human nature. I don't think that that's anything that we sort of derived. I do think that is kind of what sets us apart from the other animals, is we are able to create permanence that outlasts ourselves. I think we picked that up because we're made in the image and likeness of God. Part of that image and likeness is eternality, immortality. And those are two different things, but the eternality of God, I guess, that part of our nature is to recognize that's built in. And though we ourselves as individuals can't outlive our natural lives, our actions can. And we recognize that, and we know that, and that's part of, I think that's part of human nature that's in us, to see that we can create permanence out of the constant flux. So this idea of a cosmos, I think, comes from certain man's ability to a certain extent to order a world for himself. We live in an ordered world that we're able to make and able to see, but nature doesn't exist in that ordered thing unless we put some sense of order to it.
That would be an important controversy, whether or not order exists in objects in and of itself, in creation itself, or is it something we're simply imposing on it as a way to sort of organize? I think that goes back to Kant a little bit, right? Kant says, you know, we have these categories in our minds that make sense of the information that we're taking in.
Well, and it's not even categories in our mind. It's that we ourselves are hardwired in such a way that we are at home in our universe. I mean, I think that I use the word universe there very deliberately. That, you know, the material nature of nature itself. And he talks about the awe and sublimity that nature inspires within us, because I think partly because we recognize it as something that is unordered, it is formless and void. And you know, even in religion, we talk about, you know, the world was formless and void before God put order to it.
Right.
Right.
But there's the difference, though, for me is, you know, order that, the transcendentals, thinking maybe of, I'll name five, I think, are five big categories: the good, the true, the beautiful, unity or oneness,
right,
and then being per se. These are things I think our mind, I think following Aquinas and even Aristotle, it's our minds reach out, or intellects reach out into the real world and discover those things. And those are the things that objects have in common, versus, again, a Kant and others might say, well, Those are
logos. I mean, that's what I think that's what Kant would answer. Those are logos.
Or Hegel, maybe. Hegel might be more advancing, kind of a progress of logos through time.
Yeah,
I might read Hegel that way.
Hegel's got that idea of progress with the I think he
was kind of unwrapped,
right?
Revealing.
He was really wrestling with that permanence versus change,
right,
dichotomy there too. But Hegel's a different animal altogether. But anyway, the show is more or less about St. Thomas. So
right.
let's try to, but you're exactly right. St. Thomas would see the universal sort of essential characteristics of the order of things.
Right.
Actually.
And that we don't put the order there.
We don't put the order there.
God put it there, or the prime matter to.
Well, and I mean, that's a big distinction, whether God put it there or whether it's there in the universe itself. You know, I think what St. Thomas would say is God created the universe with order. So God, when
that
he
would
created,
be my reading of him.
Yeah, he created it with order. That's built in. So getting back to this essential thing, you know, as we said, modern man tends to, you either have to learn that you recognize the essences of things, and you have to study that. You have to go to school and learn that that's the way things are made. Or you, in modern world, you experience things, as you were saying, Bishop Barron describes it, based on just the two causes. You know, their efficient cause, you know, that which brought the thing into being, or their material cause. So when you break down the parts of a car, eventually you are left with just simply molecules.
Well, I think that's one of the conundrums of the current setting is, you're right, I think hard sciences and that train of thought would lead us to believe, again, because of the power of scientific discovery and invention, it lead us to believe that there are really only efficient and material causes. But at the same time, though, common sense is going to pull us come alongside and pull us in a different direction. Maybe not to the exclusion of that, but in a direction of, well, things do seem to have patterns. There is something I can recognize objects. I could tell the difference between a cup and a bottle and a microphone and persons and I can recognize that you and Kent, although distinct individual beings, share in common with myself that we all belong to the same human family. And the other issue I think that where Aquinas is particularly helpful in the current setting is that he's going to remind us that the world is not merely material, and physics, chemistry, et cetera, is going to try to astronomy, I should say, astrology, a whole nother show,
right.
But it's going to try to compartmentalize spiritual or non-material realities and just sort of shun them or ignore them, where I think it's he's going to tell us, no, there are things like you were mentioning, every person has an immortal soul.
Yeah, I think
and physics is never going to tell us that.
Right. I think
that I'm aware.
Yeah.
I don't know the hope right. that it would.
Right. And I think the essentialism of St. Thomas, I think that area is where you can really kind of get to the distinction between the way the scientific modern world sees man and St. Thomas sees man. And that is the question of perception, right? So science is ultimately going to say, okay, what we perceive are material reality. And we can go through subsequent layers of perception further and further. And so we see the brown table right now, but if we looked at it under a microscope, we would see, you know, the different pieces of the wood. And if we looked at the pieces of the wood in finer detail, we would see the molecules, and eventually we would get down to like the atomic level, and now we can even look at the subatomic level. So you can look at the subatomic nature of the table, and what the table really is this mixture of subatomic particles that have come together to form atoms, that have come to form together the molecules, and our perception is just simply limited in the level of which we can perceive that reality. But that base reality of subatomic particles, that is really reality. And what St. Thomas says, no, what really reality is the essences of the things that we perceive. Where I think St. Thomas does make sense is when you look at the nature of perception itself. Because when you go through that process, the one thing that you have to take for granted is that there is a perceiver, that there is something or somebody that is doing the observation. And those observations don't just come from our eyes. They don't just come from, you know, brain chemical things. Eventually, you have to have a watcher that is watching all of this and is to a certain extent not only controlling but then interpreting the perceptions that we're receiving. And that interpretation you get to a point where you say it has to be essential. There has to be a kind of an essence, a nature to it that is itself not, you know, not physical, not made up of molecules itself, but is able to perceive the molecules. And I think that's where you get to the idea of what St. Thomas has as essences. I mean, you can break down a table into its atomic things, but ultimately it has to have something that those atoms and molecules adhere to.
Particular form.
It's right? That's form, what, exactly. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
form.
It's
form. Yeah, because you could take this. We're talking about a table that we're just sitting at right now in the studio. But you could, for example, if there were no such thing as forms, the form of table is what makes it intelligible to us that we can call it a table. and know that it belongs to that category. And because you could, you're right, it's made up, the table's made up of stuff. I don't think it's real wood, but it's some kind of laminate, whatever. Yeah, you know. But yeah, let's say it was real wood. Let's say it was an Amish table.
Yeah, my mistaken perceptions, right?
Right, right. It's supposed to look like wood, but I'm guessing it's a composite material. So, but you, yeah, I mean, we could take an axe to it or a sledgehammer and bust it all up. You'd still retain the material, right? The material would still be there, assuming we didn't burn it, right? That would cause a kind of chemical change to it. But if we just simply smashed it, ground it up, in a sense, the material would still be there. All the same atoms and molecules would all be there. But what would be different? Well, one, we took an efficient cause to it, and then two, we've removed the form. It's gone through a substantial change of form.
Right.
It's kind of like you look at an apple, and if you had a nice red apple here, well, what happens when you smash it? You know, who was that comedian that used to take the big sledgehammer on stage and smash like water?
Oh, yeah, Gallagher, right?
Okay, yeah. Gallagher, he's a great destroyer of forms, okay, right, when it comes to fruit and vegetables.
But that's the point. that's sort of the point of the form, is he's not actually destroying he can't actually destroy the form of an apple.
He can through change.
The
he's form, changing it.
But the form itself, like the essential nature of it, persists even when the when it's absent, right? So the universal form is something that
it's no longer that particular apple, though. Once he smashes
it, that particular apple ceases to be an apple, right?
Right. And it becomes applesauce,
right? It is changed into something completely different.
All right, and with that, we're going to take a break, and you've been listening to The Catholic Cave, and when we come back, we're going to continue our final segment. I don't know if we're going to land the plane or not, but we're gonna maybe get it closer to the ground.
Right.
So the scan button brought you here. Awesome. We like company. Get to know us. And if you have to leave, come back. You're always welcome. Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy has a new look. It's our website. Yes, we have a new website that makes everything about Catholic Radio Indy easier. It's clean, straightforward, and simple to use. You can listen to us live, see our schedule, and our map. You can even silence your phone and take it right into Mass to follow the daily readings. And don't forget, you can get all of our programming through the podcast tab. This makes everything so much easier. So just go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and check us out.
Welcome back once again to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we are ready for the last segment of the show here, Tim, on metaphysics. And so the big question is lingering. Are we actually going to come to a point? And we've been talking about St. Thomas's metaphysics. And the reason we've been talking about St. Thomas's metaphysics is he's kind of the gold standard for Catholic thought, right? And yep. And the reason why is because he's so compatible with our descriptions of the sacraments. You know, when you talk about Christ's presence in the Eucharist, it's very easy to talk about it in terms of transubstantiation. In mm-hmm. other words, the essential nature, like we were just talking about apples with Gallagher, you know, when you... when you smash,
although
an apple,
he did favor watermelons, now they think more about
right.
it.
But when you smash that watermelon with a sledgehammer, you're changing the form of it, and so therefore you're also changing to a certain extent the essence of it. It is no longer a watermelon; it is now mm-hmm. watermelon juice or watermelon sauce or whatever you make from watermelons.
It's a mess,
right? Exactly, and so with transubstantiation, it's very easy to describe the presence of Christ in that what was formerly bread and wine, the essence, you know, that formal nature of it has now changed into the body and blood of Christ. The mm-hmm. the language is very compatible with this idea of changing into something that wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. The question around St. Thomas is that A, the only way to describe the Eucharist? And B, if we don't recognize, if we live in a world where, yeah, you can talk about essences of things, but it's really more of a convention of our perceptions of things. And I think that's the way most of the world works. Most of us a lot of people see that when we talk about the essence of a table, it's really a convention of talking about this object in the way that these molecules have come together to form this particular object at the moment right now, it's easy to categorize it as that, you know, the idea that you have to have a metaphysical commitment to that this essence is actually something that's really there. Most people don't have that metaphysical commitment, and don't think about tables that way. They don't talk about tables that way. In today's age of science, it's much easier to talk about things in terms of how they change, not in how they stay the same. And so the idea of formal and essential natures of things, you know, it's something that a lot of people don't even think about, don't know. And even more people would probably disagree with the idea that the universe is made up that way. And yet that's how we continue to talk about the Eucharist. So, is St. Thomas's metaphysics the only way to talk about the Eucharist?
I don't know. That's a good question. If it's the only way, I'd be, pardon me, interested in hearing other ways to describe what's the reality of what's happening with the Blessed Sacrament there at the consecration. Why I think Aquinas is super helpful is, well, I'll back up a quick second. So we talk about the word transubstantiation, trans meaning kind of like a crossing over, transatlantic flight, or there's a crossing over, and then substantiation. We're talking about form and matter during the program, and more, I guess, more officially, let's say, instead of more formally, really the term is a substantial form. Things have substantial forms. The problem, I think, Aristotle points out, and Aquinas does too, when we're trying to wrap our minds around objects in the universe being comprised of form and matter, act and potency, is that it's with artifacts or non-living entities, it's a little harder to see the forms at times, because a chair, for example, we know what a chair is, but you can use artifacts in a lot of variety of different ways. If I stand on the chair to change a light bulb in the ceiling, is it now a ladder? Because I'm using it like a ladder, because I'm not sitting on it, I'm standing on it. So he says it can be confusing. So it's a lot easier when you think about permanence and change. The permanence that you see is due to the substantial form endures throughout the life of an organism. So you see that clearly with plants going from seed to its reaching its actual mature state, reaches its full potency. And so you see that in human beings. This is the pro-life argument that from conception until death, what endures? There's lots of change, lots of growth, lots of development, self-directed, but what endures is what? It's always a human being, because the essence, the nature, the substantial form is always there. So I do think Aquinas is helpful for us to talk not just about sacraments, but we can talk about it in terms of, like, again, value in the pro-life conversations. But particularly around transubstantiation, I think it's super helpful, because when we understand that there are substantial forms with matter, also you can think about these appearances described as they're called formally accidents. That there's a great mystery there, but it does help us understand that there's something. In the deepest sense, there has been a change to reality through the power of the priesthood of Christ himself changing bread and wine into his body, blood, soul, and divinity. And you see it with the eyes of faith, but the eyes of faith, I would say, to think about faith in a very technical, theological, like in our prayer act of faith, faith is simultaneously two things. It's an act of the will where we choose to affirm, assent, and believe the truth that God himself has given us.
Right.
So it's not just, it's not a feeling. Feelings can get in the way of that. So it's an act of faith, but it's not this blind faith at all. It's that we have very good reasons to believe in God's word, what he's told, the truths that he's given us through Holy Mother Church.
Right. And you know, this comes from St. Thomas, but, you know, St. Thomas says, you know, there's not two types of truth. There's not two sources of truth. There's just truth. And so religion, religious truth, revealed truth, that which we learn through our faith, and scientific truth, that which we learn through observation, are never going to conflict. They may appear to conflict, but they're never going
to
conflict.
You have to work through.
You have to work through
contradictions or frictions.
And so, you know, when you scientifically break things down to the molecular level, the subatomic level, and recognize and have, I guess, in the back of your mind that these atoms can then come and reconstitute anything. That they can be put together in any number of ways. The reality is really like a big set of Legos. And
Legos are fun, but expensive, but they're budget busters,
but that the order that these Legos are put together are based on reason that's applied to the matter itself. In other words, the reason is not there latent within the matter, but it's reason applied to the matter. If you view reality that way, that doesn't conflict with the truths of the faith, if that's true, right? And so the question is, then, since that's not St. Thomas's metaphysical position, right? St. Thomas does say that the order of things resides within the matter of it. So the molecules mm-hmm. themselves have, you know, you don't just have interchangeable molecules that can one day be a table and the next day be part of the dirt. The matter of the table itself is either something that's not made up of molecules, or that the matter itself, you've got table molecules or dirt molecules or tree molecules. If that is part of revealed religion, then that conflicts with science. Or if it's part of science, then the science conflicts with religion. That's kind of the conundrum you're in. If you kind of look at it and say, yeah, matter, the order of things, the form of things resides within its molecular material, you're kind of in this little conundrum.
I think that's a really good objection that you're raising to the real presence, because you're right, according to the...
No, not to the real presence, no, but to transubstantiation. So there's a distinction there.
Well, you can't get to the real presence if what seems like what you're describing... The transubstantiation wouldn't happen according to that account.
No, sure it would. Sure it would. Yeah. It would. It's not that God doesn't exist in a world full of molecules.
No, I was saying the science. I thought where I was tracking, maybe I got lost. I thought the case you were describing, not that this is your personal view, but that someone who's strictly a materialist would argue that against transubstantiation irreconcilable,
sure,
because the atoms and molecules can't change.
We're coming up on a break, but there's a big difference, and maybe we need to talk about this.
Wish it was a break. Yeah. We're gonna have to come up to another show.
But there's a big difference between being a strict materialist and recognizing that order and form and things are not latent within matter. That's a big difference between perspectives, and so you can recognize that order and form don't exist within the matter of things, and still recognize the existence of God, the existence of souls, the existence of
you can affirm those things.
No. I'm saying metaphysically they're all compatible.
That one up in another show.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. We'll have to take that.
I don't
up
know if I'd
show.
Agree with that. I have to so, think. That'll be good because I need to think about that one for a while.
Right. Because I think the idea that the form of things resides in the molecules of things, and that is Thomas's position. I think it's hard to argue that Thomas does not say that the form resides in the matter. And material reality is molecules.
The table's the difficulty here. What about if you, instead of using a table, what if your object for that speculation would be a person? Wouldn't you say a person has, is guided intrinsically by its own principle of development.
Sure, but that doesn't reside within the material of my being.
Wouldn't
we
that be DNA and chromosomes and
no,
stuff?
No, no, DNA and chromosomes are just proteins, which are just molecules, which are just atoms.
What guides our development?
Exactly. There's a spiritual element that does, but it doesn't reside within the DNA. And well, that's, and I think that's the
yeah,
the
I agree with that, but right. That wouldn't be what the materialist is arguing.
But that would be what St. Thomas is arguing, is that the form does reside within the DNA.
Huh. I don't read them that way. Anyway, we're out of time.
Yep. And with that, we need to wrap up. This is episode 3 of our series on metaphysics. We'll pick up with episode 4 next week. Obviously, we've got a bunch of questions that we still need to address, and we will do that next week on The Catholic Cave. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.